We are back on the record for the redirect.
Thank you. Professor Rutter, beginning of your cross-examination, Mr. Williams put up a PowerPoint slide that had a list of 6 or 7 points that petitioner's experts have made in this litigation. And I believe he had it under the title Biologic Coherence. I can't recall the exact language. Did any one of those points, 6 to 7 points that were listed, change your opinion in this case?
No.
And one point stated that there's a wide variability in individual blood and brain levels of mercury. Is this indicative of anything?
No. As I mentioned at the time, I think, huge individual variability is a feature of almost anything that one looks at with human beings. So that, for example, the range at when children's teeth come through is very variable. The age at which people reach puberty is very variable. But that doesn't mean that there is some interaction with an environmental factor. Variation is part of the biology.
Now, Mr. Williams was also asking you about inorganic mercury persisting in the brain. Is inorganic mercury specific to vaccinations?
No, not at all. It applies to a wide range of things like dental amalgam, for example, so that once one moves to aspects of mercury that are not specific to thimerosal, then one is moving into a range of studies that are concerned with mercury as a possible risk factor, but not necessarily thimerosal.
Now, you were asked a lot of questions about studies that have been done pertaining to neuroinflammation and its purported role or association with autism. What causal inferences can be drawn from any of these studies that were discussed here today pertaining to neuroinflammation?
Well, none. They are hypothesis-generating, if you like. They're putting forward speculative suggestions. And as I indicated, a beginning of much science comes from telling an imaginative story as to what might be the case. So they do that, but they don't demonstrate causation at any sort of level at the moment.
You were also asked some questions pertaining to head circumference and autism. What are the head circumference findings that are unique to autism?
It is the normal head circumference at birth, and the increase that takes place during the preschool years. It is a very characteristic feature. As I indicated, it does vary from child to child, but it is something which is quite unusual in relation to other neurodevelopmental disorders.
Now, you were also shown a study by Mr. Williams. It's a future or current study. They're currently recruiting participants that are looking at minocycline to treat childhood regressive autism. Do you recall that line of questioning?
Yes.
Does this study establish causation at all?
No. I mean, the study hasn't been done for a start off, but it falls into the group of things. I think I drew a parallel with fenfluramine and secretin that might result in something of interest, but hasn't been done. It is in any case an open study, so that even at completion it will still be rather inconclusive. So no, it doesn't take us one stage further at all.
Now, you were also asked whether it's possible that individuals could be susceptible to mercury, and I believe you said it was possible but not established. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Based on what's known about exposure to mercury, have we seen any evidence of a hypersusceptibility to mercury?
No. I mean, the experimental studies that have been done have tended to show results that applied to the group as a whole rather than if you like, outliers with a very unusual response. The studies have not been sufficient in number, or the subjects sufficient in number, to rule out the possibility of a hypersusceptible group, but they certainly don't point to that being an issue.
You also asked a question with regard to whether, in your opinion, you think that further resources should be used to conduct a follow-up study of the Verstraten study, and you said no. Is it just an economic consideration, or are there other considerations at work as to why you would not recommend any further such study?
No, it's not just economics. It's a question of one wanting to put one's resources into things that are likely to pay off. So let me answer it a somewhat different way around. We've talked primarily, for obvious reasons, about the hypothesis that thimerosal is a causative factor. But in the course of doing that, we've touched on various studies that have looked at mercury as distinct from thimerosal. The evidence that it's worthwhile doing further research on thimerosal, I find unconvincing. I wouldn't put much money in that direction. I'm much more neutral, or positive, however you like to look at it, about the effects of mercury coming in other ways. So we know that mercury in high dosage is a neurotoxin. So, for example, I mentioned the Norwegian study, which is, I'm not one of the principal investigators, but I am on the advisory group for that study, and it is looking at a range of variables during the prenatal and early postnatal phase that might be relevant, and obviously mercury in fish is one of the things that is being looked at. So I definitely don't rule out the possibility that mercury might play a role. The evidence is weak. On the other hand, it's not so weak that it isn't worthwhile taking that further forward. It's not the only hypothesis being examined there. Indeed, there are quite a range of them, and there are a range of biological measures being taken to try and get a tight hold on this. But we do need to be concerned with possible environmental causes of disease, and so I would put that on the list of possibilities.
You also asked a couple questions, or more than a couple questions, about the individual epidemiological studies that you cited in your report and discussed during your direct testimony. Now, you were asked about the individual studies, but is that a proper way to look at the epidemiology that has arisen in this area?
No, one needs to put them together. I was explaining from referring, I think, to my Academy of Medical Sciences report that in science you need to not only combine multiple studies, but you need to combine multiple research strategies, and that the strength of findings is very much influenced by doing that. It's very rare to find a study that on its own changes things completely, either for or against. It has to be taken as a whole.
You were asked a couple questions about the DeSoto paper, which is Petitioner's Master List 423. Do you have any further comments about that paper?
Yes, I was taken to task in referring to differences where I was told with dealing with hair mercury, and I should have been focusing on blood. But as far as I can see, reading the paper carefully, what I was talking about was what I said I was talking about, i.e. findings on blood levels.
You were also asked a series of questions about the Palmer study, recent study. Does that study speak at all to the issue of whether or not thimerosal in vaccines causes autism?
No, because it is, again, I draw the parallel with the Norwegian study. It is dealing with a more general issue as to whether mercury in its various forms through various routes may be causing risks. And at the present time, we don't really know enough to know whether they do or they don't. I do see that as worthwhile, but because it is looking at pollutants from factories, the connection with thimerosal is indirect, to put it mildly. A further issue in relation to the question of the tightness of the association is that I note now, in looking at the paper more carefully, that they make the point about you really need to take account wind patterns and rainfall and so on, and that they weren't able to do that at that time. So it's an interesting hypothesis generating study, but in itself it doesn't take us very far on mercury generally, and it doesn't really take us anywhere in relation to thimerosal.
And finally, Mr. Williams asked you about your participation in the Honda paper,
yes,
which I refer to as the Honda study.
Yes.
The study in Japan looking at MMR, and he drew the analogy to your testimony in the United Kingdom that you've given in the General Medical Council with regard to Dr. Andrew Wakefield. Do you have any comments on that, the analogy that Mr. Williams was drawing?
Yes. The situation is really a very different one. With the benefit of hindsight, I can quite see that it might have been prudent to have made that overt, although it was well known that I had played that role. The difference is as follows. The British law is that the responsibility of an expert witness is to the court. It is not to whoever has called you. And that is the difference, I realize, from the American system. So that it was not a conflict in that sort of sense. And indeed, to go back to the lead situation, that wasn't a court case, but actually I came out saying there was sufficient evidence that lead was damaging, that it should be withdrawn. So with Wakefield, the situation was that he was funded to do the study. He was funded in relation to litigants. Many of the cases involved in his study were involved in the litigation. So there was a very direct involvement, which he concealed. My involvement with the Honda study, first of all, I wasn't funded to do it. It was not my analyses, and I was an expert witness who was never called. So I certainly had no intention of concealing it. Perhaps I should have made it overt. But it is fundamentally different from the Wakefield situation, where there were direct financial issues involved and direct involvement of litigation, direct involvement of the cases in the litigation with the study.
Thank you. I have no further questions.
Just one. So in your work with on the MMR vaccine starting in 2003, it was the British government that was paying you?
No.
Oh, who was paying you?
The drug company was paying me, so that the way that it works is that obviously somebody has to be paying. There are situations where the court pays directly, and I have campaigned for some years, unsuccessfully, regrettably, that all expert witnesses should be called by the court and not by one or other side. At the moment, they have to be called by and therefore paid by, but you have to abide by the rules that you actually are not responsible to the lawyers who called you. You are responsible to the court.
But your bills were submitted to Glaxo.
Yes.
Thank you.
Do my colleagues have any questions?
Yes, I do have a couple. Doctor, I wondered if you would, if you had any more comments to make on the Young, Geyer, and Geyer study that you were given before the break. If you had, did you have a chance during the lunch break to read the full article?
Yes, I did. Not a lot to add. As I say, I think it's a poor study. It used a database that could have been used for a conventional cohort study, but it was analyzed on a time trends basis, and they put cases in inappropriate groups. So there are a lot of other things that could be said, and doubtless Dr. Fonbon will go into some of those details. But on those grounds alone, I do not see that as a study worth very much.
All right. And just one other, perhaps it's a short series of questions, but you were asked by Mr. Williams about the petitioner's theory of neuroinflammation being caused by inorganic mercury as a potential cause of autism, and you indicated your view that that was basically a speculative theory. Now, as I look at that theory, there are really two parts of it. First, that inorganic mercury can cause neuroinflammation. And second, that neuroinflammation can cause autism. Do you see either of those two parts as more potentially meritorious than the others, or are they both equally speculative in your mind?
Well, good question. Let me think for just a moment how I can most helpfully respond on that. Inflammation is a very non-specific sort of process. So it's a bit like fever. So the number of medical conditions that cause fever are enormous. Anything from an infection to cancer. And so there it is indicating a non-specific response to something going wrong. So the question in terms of inflammation here is it more than that? So the notion that inorganic mercury might cause neuroinflammation, I don't find a particularly startling theory, because it's at a very general level. And in terms of application to thimerosal, one's got to move beyond looking at a general bodily defense mechanism, which is what inflammation is about, so that, again, if one takes fever and infections as an example, you need the inflammation, as it were, to gear up the body defenses to deal with the infection. So it's a good aspect, if you like, because it's part of the body defense processes. But once one moves to the situation as to whether thimerosal is causing this, you've got a series of different propositions that have to be added in. To begin with, is thimerosal having an equivalent to the inorganic mercury that is being shown in some of these more basic science studies? The answer is yes, it might be, But the minute you do that, you, of course, have to recognize that mercury comes from many different sources, and therefore there would be the additional requirement of showing that, in this case, it did come from the thimerosal, not from the factory up the road or the amalgam in the teeth or so on. Then you've got the further problem that if you are dealing with something which is occurring throughout the brain, you've then got to explain why it leads to the particular kind of pattern that you find with autism. And by that I mean not just the symptoms, that's one important part, but also the increase of head size during the preschool years, the particular kind of cognitive, social cognitive abnormalities that are encapsulated by theory of mind, and so on. There are a whole range of things. So the notion that neuroinflammation or oxidative stress plays a role, you are on a mechanism that we know is very widespread, and so the challenge really is it's not that the idea itself is ridiculous, but does it apply in these circumstances to this outcome? That's where the speculation comes in.
All right, thank you. Nothing further from me.
These questions provoked any questions from counsel?
Not from petition.
Yeah. I think that concludes our testimony for the day. Thank you. You're excused from your
thank you.
Stand. And as currently advised, we are to resume hearing from respondents' witnesses tomorrow at 9 a.m. Are there any further matters from counsel that you believe we need to address this afternoon before we go off the record?
Not from the petitioners.
No, ma'am.
Thank you. We are adjourned until tomorrow.